So did CNN's Mark Lamont Hill really call for the elimination of Israel at the UN yesterday?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Do you know what clickbait is? That's the term for some catchy headlines, some catchy news, something that is going to get your attention just to get you to click on it, but there's nothing really there behind it. It's sensationalized. Well, I want you to know the lead into today's program was not clickbait. This was not something sensationalistic that when you actually hear what happened, you'll say, oh, it was no big deal. No, no. Today's show, what we just said, asking about CNN contributor and Temple University professor Mark Lamont Hill, his comments at the UN yesterday, they are extreme. And we're going to break them down. We're going to talk about them today right here on the thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. So, of course, you can weigh in on what we're going to talk about. Of course, you can weigh in on Professor Hill's comments by all means. But and I'm going to read something that he's posted on his Twitter feed supporting his comments and saying that he's being blasted for nothing and it's a fake controversy. So I'm going to read someone defending him. We'll give that side as well. You're free to weigh in on either side of that. But any Jewish-related question you have of any kind related to Judaism, the Jewish people, Israel today, the Hebrew language, relating to the Hebrew Bible, Jewish background to the New Testament, any Jewish-related question that you have, phone lines are open now. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. All right, so yesterday, Professor Mark Lamont Hill, who's best known as a CNN contributor, regular CNN commentator, he was speaking at the International Day of Palestinian Solidarity, International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinians at the UN. Now, we know it's been well documented for decades that the UN has a blatant history of anti-Semitism. In that sense, it is a world body with a history of hatred of the Jewish state, demonizing of the Jewish people, to the point that Ambassador Nikki Haley frequently spoke against the UN, exposed its biases to the point that President Trump has withdrawn America from some UN organizations because of its blatant anti-Semitism and anti-Israel stances. So the fact that Professor Hill was speaking in that context itself isn't surprising, given the fact that he has a history of bashing Israel, of very negative comments against Israel. So I want you to hear, this is the conclusion to his speech yesterday at the UN.
To commit to political action, grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea.
Okay, hear those words, a free Palestine, from where? From the river to the sea. We're going to look at a map in a moment and see exactly what that means. And then we're going to look at the history of that quote so you know exactly what he was saying. This was not random. These were not words that just happened to come out without premeditation. This was specific. This was intentional. There was a clear meaning to it. And it means the end of the Jewish state. Oh, doesn't necessarily call for the destruction of the Jewish state or the murder of Jews, although he made very clear that the way change is going to come will involve violence. He said, we absolutely advocate nonviolence, but let's recognize that you're not always going to have that. And that, you know, change doesn't come just through the ways of Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. There's got to be violence as well. So in his speech, he does make that clear. If violence is necessary, you use it. But let's first look for a moment at Professor Hill's history. I could cite article after article and quote after quote. Jerusalem Post, March 8th, 2017. It's quite a lengthy article. Mark Lamont Hill's one-sided view of racism in the Middle East. All right, with lots of documentation. So that was March of last year. Let's look at twitchy.com. May 15th of this year, Mark Lamon Hill gets fact-checked over Palestine-Israel hot take, but keeps digging when challenged. Again, and then October 22nd, camera.org. This is specifically a news-related organization that just focuses on misreporting about Israel and the Jewish people in the news. Here it is, October 22nd. And again, all carefully documented. Mark Lamon Hill moves from justifying terrorism to promoting it. He moves from justifying terrorism to promoting it. By the way, when I checked CNN a little bit earlier today, maybe 3 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago, I didn't see anything on their website whatsoever. Nothing on the website condemning his remarks. Nothing on the website distancing themselves from his remarks. If it's up now, I haven't seen it. So this is extreme. This is ugly rhetoric. This is dangerous stuff, friends. And the meaning is clear. So let's first break this down. What does it mean, a free Palestine from the river to the sea? Well, if you're familiar with a map of Israel, you know that on the east border is the Jordan River, okay? The Jordan River on the east, and on the west is the Mediterranean Sea. And I've got a map in front of me right now, and you see all the way on the far west, south side, is Gaza Strip, okay? So that borders the sea. If you look over a big chunk of what is Israel here, and it's in a different color because this would be called disputed territories or occupied territories by critics, is what's called the West Bank. Why? Because it's the West Bank of the Jordan River. All right, so what Hill is calling for is free Palestine from the river Jordan to the sea. In other words, every square inch that is currently Israel, plus West Bank and Gaza Strip, every square inch that is currently the Jewish state of Israel will now be a free Palestine. He doesn't call it an Israeli-Palestinian state. No, a free Palestine. Not just freedom, in his view, freedom for those in the West Bank and freedom for those in Gaza Strip. No, freedom for the entire country. Meaning what exactly, Professor Hill? Is there any ambiguity? Well, let's recognize that groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, they're on campuses all over America and abroad, I believe, as well. You'll hear chants like this. This is a chant from Rutgers University, where Students for Justice in Palestine are chanting words almost identical to those of Professor Mark Lamont Hill. Did you hear it? From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Well, who's living there? Who are the bulk of the people living there? Still the majority population, all right? But occupying the bulk of that territory, who is that? That's the Jewish people. That's the Jewish state of Israel, all right? And that is now going to be free. Why? Because it's supposed to be all Palestinian. Now, if you're still not 100% sure about the meaning of this, it's like a doctor telling you, you're sick from head to toe. Well, that doesn't just mean you have a cold or an infected toe. That means your whole body's sick. Doctor says cancer spread throughout your entire body. It doesn't just mean your arm is unhealthy. When someone says from the river to the sea, and the people living between the river and the sea are primarily the Jewish people in the Jewish state of Israel, that's telling you want that whole territory, and that will now be Palestine, free Palestine. But let's take a look. I wrote an article just today, this morning, got up, saw what was happening, immediately posted this article on the stream, stream.org. You can read it there. And it's called, yes, CNN's Mark Lamon Hill really did call for the elimination of Israel. You scroll down in the article, I've got some quotes from Hamas leaders. So say in the article, if you're still unsure, just ask Hamas leader Khaled Mashal what the words mean. So in December 2012, Mashal returned to Gaza for a, quote, victory rally after Israel's crushing defeat of Hamas in what Israel called Operation Pillar of Defense. They called it a victory rally because the war ended, but it was a terrible defeat. So as the Guardian, UK Guardian, reported, Hamas leader Khaled Mashal vowed Gaza's rulers would never give up, quote, an inch of the land to Israel, in an uncompromising speech before tens of thousands of cheering supporters in a triumphalist, quote, victory rally in Gaza City. Hamas said 500,000 people there. Yes, Mashal affirmed to his enthusiastic hearers, quote, Palestine is ours from the river to the sea and from the south to the north. Can I read that again? His exact words. Palestine is ours from the river to the sea and from the south to the north. There will be no concession on an inch of the land. We will never recognize the legitimacy of the Israeli occupation, and therefore there is no legitimacy for Israel, no matter how long it will take. I'd say that's pretty clear. Oh, I've got another quote for you. I've got another quote. The Hamas charter, all right, the original Hamas charter, it states that our, quote, our struggle against the Jews is very great and very serious. They say, of course, we mean the Jews living in Israel. And it calls for the eventual creation of an Islamic state in Palestine in place of Israel and the Palestinian territory. So all absorbed in an Islamic state and the obliteration or dissolution of Israel. That's the original charter. And then 2014, another Hamas leader used similar words. So memory.org reported this, and I've got a link in my article. Go to stream.org. I've got a link in the article, and you can click on the link, and you can actually watch the speech, the Arabic speech with the English translation. During a military parade conducted in Gaza on December 14th, 2014, Khalil al-Haya of the Hamas leadership declared, quote, Palestine, all of Palestine, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, is pure Arab Islamic land, which we will share with no one. So it has to be, the German word, Judenrein, free of Jews. Let me read it again. Palestine, all of Palestine, from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River, is pure Arab Islamic land, which we will share with no one. It's 2014. So, Matt, if you could grab that quote again, I want you to hear it one more time out of the mouth of Mark Lamont Hill. This is exactly what he was calling for. These are his words. And when he asked for justice requires it, listen to what he said.
To commit to political action, grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea.
You heard it. You heard it. Clear as day.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast on the Line of Fire. And before I take your calls, 866-34-TRUTH, any Jewish-related question you have of any kind, phone lines are open. And feel free to call to defend Professor Hill's comments and say why you think I'm misrepresenting him or why you think he was right. 866-34-TRUTH. Of course, we copied him on the article a few years back when I was on Piers Morgan opposite him, and we had a little duel of words on the broadcast. I link those at the end of my stream article, by the way. I interacted with him briefly on Twitter, and let's have a formal debate, and he expressed openness to it, but then never got back to me thereafter. So much for that. But in any case, what I want to do, before we go to your calls, I want to read a thread that Mark Lamont Hill linked to on his Twitter feed. I was just looking to see what he had to say about these things, because I believe CNN needs to discipline him, and they need to renounce his comments as well. And these days, you get bumped off a network for the smallest thing. It's amazing he's still there after some of the things he said. Now, maybe people shouldn't be bumped so quickly. I'm fine with that. Let people apologize or clarify. We don't have to be so quick to condemn. If someone is contrite, makes things right. But it's amazing that he could say the kinds of things he says and still be on the air. You know, if you think of people getting bounced off Twitter for the smallest reasons, and then you have Louis Farrakhan likening Jews to termites who obviously need to be exterminated, and he's still there. And Mark Lamont Hill making comments like this, and he's still on CNN. Ironic, to say the least. But this is a series of tweets from Omar Badr, just checking his bio. He's with the Arab American Institute, the USA. And he says this quick thread on the manufactured controversy that is smear campaign regarding Mark Lamont Hill's UN speech. So let me just stop there. Isn't it wild that someone can say something totally outrageous in a context filled with anti-Zionism, anti-Israel sentiments, even anti-Semitic sentiments? Okay, no question, the sentiments were intense and many of them ugly at this UN meeting yesterday. That Mark Lamont Hill can say things totally inflammatory and the people there know exactly what he's saying. And then when you critique it, it's a smear campaign. Isn't that wild? Isn't that wild? Okay, so what Omar Badr says, let me start by addressing the competing visions of the one state solution. Palestinians made a massive compromise in the 80s, accepting a two-state solution where they should get less than one-fourth of their historic homeland. Israel rejected that compromise and kept building illegal settlements on top of the occupied Palestinian territories. Every word of that's nonsense. Every word of that is nonsense. Let me explain why. Number one, in the 1930s, an offer was made to the Arab inhabitants of the land and the Jewish people to give the vast majority of the land to the Arabs and a very small portion to the Jews. The Jews accepted it. The Arabs said no. They were living side by side. And the Jews had the ultimate historic claim to the land, but they were living side by side. And as Jews were cultivating the land, many more Arabs moving in, all right, they were given a very generous offer. They refused it. 1947, they still get a big chunk of the land. Israel still gets a part of the land. The UN partition plan, potentially very dangerous borders for Israel. Israel accepts it. Arab leaders reject it. David Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, pleading with Arab neighbors. Pamphlets being sent out. Radio announcements being made in Arabic. Stay, stay. You're our neighbors. There's room for all of us. Palestinian leadership, wasn't called Palestinian then. Arab leadership saying, we're going to drive you out. We're going to destroy you. This is going to be the final war. You're going to be killed. So they reject it twice. Solutions far better than any two-state solution since. Everybody would have been living in a two-state solution for decades, even go back to the 30s, for pressing 90 years, had they simply accepted the offers. They've refused them. And in the 80s, you still had plenty of Palestinian leaders who would not recognize the Jewish state of Israel. And as far as illegal settlements, Israel had the right to build settlements, whether it's the best for peace or not, you could debate, but Israel had the right to build settlements in land that was acquired during war. There was an attempt, 1967, Israel thankfully able to preempt it with God's help, that would have wiped out the nation. The surrounding nations ready to wipe them out. Israel acquired territory in the law, and under international law, they can build settlements if they want there. Next. All right, so then he says this. As a result of Israel's rejection of the incredibly generous Palestinian compromise, it's even mind-boggling to read these words. We're confronted with the current one-state reality. The only question is, what should this one state look like? Should everyone's basic rights be respected in it? Well, my answer would be yes. And Israel's ultimate desire would be yes. Is it going to happen? Another question. Netanyahu supports a one-state solution. He categorically rejects a viable Palestinian state, but he is actively destroying Palestinian society and building a one-state reality where Palestinians are a subservient population to be kept down and dominated. Israel's not perfect. I've never said Israel's perfect in these ways. I've often said where I disagree and Israel could do better. But this much I know. If Palestinian leadership clearly worked together for peace and clearly worked against terrorism and did not name schools after terrorists and kindergarten playgrounds after terrorists and honor the memory of Nazis and clearly said we will live together in peace, we absolutely recognize this as your historic Jewish homeland. It's also the homeland, historic homeland for many of us. We want to live in peace side by side. Things would change dramatically and radically. And the lifestyle, the well-being of the Palestinians would increase dramatically, incredibly. It would be good for everyone. Continue. By contrast, Mark supports a one-state vision where everyone has equal rights. Well, why call it a free Palestine? Isn't it Israel now? What about over 6 million Jews for whom it's not Palestine? It's Israel. What about them? What do you mean from river to sea? Why use that rhetoric? Whatever you think of this vision, it isn't calling for destruction, but merely a transformation from a discriminatory state that privileges some over others into an equal state for all. Then don't use that terminology, and don't justify violent uprising, and don't engage in all kinds of anti-Zionist, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic rhetoric over the years that is blatantly factually wrong and sides with very, very wrong causes and those that are on the side of the destruction of the Jewish people. And his solution means the end of the Jewish state. Elimination. I didn't use the word destruction here, but I did use the word elimination, and I did use the word end, because it would mean that. If you haven't vigorously opposed Israel's oppressive occupation of the Palestinian territories, destroying two-state solution, but find yourself troubled by Marx's support for a single democratic state, you should check your moral compass, because it's not working well. If a one-state solution would work where Israel could still lead as its historic homeland, then great. There are people like Caroline Glick and other Jewish leaders, Israeli leaders, advocating for that. All violence against civilians is despicable and illegitimate, but if you have a problem with the right of occupied people to resist the theft of their lands and the stripping of their rights, not through terrorism, it's not Mark you have a problem with, it's international law. Well, Mark did advocate violent resistance. He advocated that. And there's plenty of violent resistance against civilians and against non-combative military. If you haven't protested Israel's atrocities, killing thousands of Palestinian civilians condemned by every major human rights organization, including Israeli ones, but are troubled by Mark's acknowledgement of the right to resist, make an effort to rid yourself of moral hypocrisy. Well, when Israel is guilty of an atrocity, which is rare, when they are, I'll speak against it and I'll say it's wrong. But for the most part, knowing what happens with the Israeli military, and again, it's far from perfect, but knowing what happens with the Israeli military, in point of fact, they do everything they can to minimize civilian casualties. Everything they can. I'll say this again, if you're not aware, when you start your time in the IDF, when you begin serving there, the first thing, you're taught ethics. You can't leave base without your ID and your ethics card. And I know many people who've served in the IDF, and the parents of many young people who've served in the IDF. And they'll often call for prayer because they're going in to try to root out terrorists. But they say, please pray. It's really difficult because we have to have this caution, this caution. In other words, we can't just shoot. We have to have this caution, this caution, this caution before we do it. So here I'm looking at this, the Ruach Tzahal, the code of ethics of the Israeli Defense Forces. And it's, you know, the tradition of the IDF and its military heritage is the Israeli Defense Forces, the tradition of the State of Israel, its democratic principles, laws and institutions, etc. Israel's far from perfect. There's no question about it. And as I told the Palestinians at a conference in May, I'll gladly stand with them. They renounce the terrorism that takes place, if they'll renounce their erroneous replacement theology, and if they'll generate a heart that sympathizes with the slaughter of the Israelis as well. But so wherever Omar Bardaz is speaking truth, I agree with it. But so much of what's said there is so incredibly imbalanced, unjust, and utterly ludicrous. By the way, I don't know if you heard the interview we did with Daphne and Andrew Kirk a few weeks back from Generation to Generation Ministries. They have a documentary, and we linked to it. We talked about it. They have a documentary where they brought a bunch of young people from America and other nations. They brought them over to Israel to decide for themselves who was on the side of righteousness and justice in the conflict there. And they met with Palestinian leader after Palestinian leader, Palestinian young people, Palestinians who had lost family and loved ones, mayors and different ones, educated. They met with one after another, and then the same on the Israeli side. And all of them concluded that Israel was in the right in the conflict. That was their conclusion. And most all of them went very open to, well, they all went open, but most went really having no idea where they stood on this until they were exposed face to face. Could Israel do better? Absolutely. Are Professor Hill's comments absolutely outrageous, dangerous, ugly, to be renounced? Absolutely. All right, we'll come back with your calls. I'm passionate about these things. Hope you are too. We'll be right back.
fading flame. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, I'm looking over at our Facebook feed, and I see that Daphne Kirk, our friend from England, just joined. Daphne, I don't know if you heard, I mentioned you a moment ago in terms of the documentary that you and Andrew produced so powerfully, taking young people over to Israel and letting them sit in firsthand, meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders so they could sort out for themselves who was right and wrong in the conflict. So feel free to post links right there in that Facebook feed, Daphne, that will help all of our folks that are over there. Welcome, welcome to our thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Okay, I'm going to go to your calls in a moment. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related question you have of any kind, phone lines are open. But I've got some exciting news for you. I told you a couple months back that we were closing out our Israel tour for February 1st through 10th, that we'd be closing it out, and then said we were able to extend it a little bit. Well, check with our folks again earlier this week. There's still room. We've been able to open up more space. There's still room, and you can come. You got to get your funds in immediately, but you can come for what will literally be the trip of a lifetime, February 1st through 10th, Holy Fire in the Holy Land, an unforgettable time, day and night together, amazing tour on the ground, amazing times together at night. It's going to be an extraordinary, life-changing, life-enriching time, and we'll get to spend a lot of time together while we're there as well. So sign up now. Go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Listen, while you're there, and you'll find the banner right on the homepage. While you're there, become a torchbearer, become a monthly supporter. I'm going to give you a financial incentive to do it. There's a special discount for our torchbearers. So if you're giving $1 a day per month, so $30 or more per day to support per month to support the ministry, basically we give you almost all that right back towards the tour. So sign up to be a torchbearer first, and then sign up to be on the tour. This way we can bless you right back as you bless us and stand with us. And I can't tell you how impacting it is to go on these tours, except to say there's a reason people from around the world come streaming into Israel all through the year. And there's a reason people go and talk about it the rest of their lives. And there's a reason people go multiple times. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to the phone, starting in Winston-Salem. Chuck, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, how you doing today, Dr. Brown?
Doing very well, sir. How about you?
I'm not complaining, man. I talked to you about 2 or 3 weeks ago, getting your input on what would be easier to learn as far as Greek or Hebrew, and I appreciate it.
I remember the call. Yeah, I remember
yes,
the call.
Yes, sir. So I have a different one today. I'm into apologetics and have been, you know, talking a lot with Jehovah's Witnesses, different people of different faiths. And one of the things I'm trying to get a grasp on is the term Son of God as it's applied to Jesus himself. I know that men, particularly like the children of Israel or Israel, were called sons of God. Believers are called sons of God, even yeah. The angels and so forth. But as far as Jesus, in the time that Jesus was living, the first century, I guess you would say, what was the understanding of Son of God? I think Peter called him the Son of God, and he said, flesh has not revealed this to you.
Yep.
I think other people, I know he referred to himself as the Son of Man, so I'll stop right there, and I'll let you go in.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Chuck. So the first thing is there were lots of different nuances and particular understandings as to what exactly was meant by Son of God. As you mentioned, the children of Israel as a nation, they were called God's son, his firstborn. The king, upon coronation, it would seem, was designated God's son. And we corporately, say the children of Israel, people of God corporately, would be called sons of the living God. Those were all phrases that were used. And yes, B'nai Elohim, the angels, sons of God. In other words, these spirit beings of this divine spirit quality. But is there more to it? Son of God in an even more exalted way. Because the Davidic king was called the Son of God, right? Psalm 2, for example, and other places, and even the, you know, the most highly exalted in the Psalms. Because he was called God's son, and because the Messiah was the preeminent son of David, the greater son of David, so the Messiah in an even more exalted way could be called God's son. Now, I want to draw attention to two passages, one in Mark 14 and one in Mark 15. In Mark, the 14th chapter, as Jesus is being questioned by the high priest and the religious leadership, he's asked some specific questions. So in Mark 14:61, when he's being accused, it says he kept silent, did not answer anything. Again, the high priest questioned him, Mark 14:61, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," Jesus said. So Yeshua answers, "I am, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Powerful One and coming with the clouds of heaven," a clear reference to Mark, to Daniel 7. Tearing his clothes, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, says, "Why do we still need witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy. What seems right to you?" So they perceived what he was saying as on some level being blasphemous, that he uniquely described himself as the Son of God. In other words, clearly a heavenly exalted figure. If we then scroll down, turn pages, whatever you got, in Mark, yeah, the 15th chapter, after the crucifixion, when the Roman centurion sees the way he dies, it says in Mark chapter 15, verse 39, Mark 15, 39, when the centurion who was standing opposite him saw the way he breathed his last, this is a Roman centurion, he said, "This man really was the Son of God." So he realized that there's something different, not just like a human being can be God's son, you and I are God's children, but here, when he sees Yeshua breathe his last, he says, "This man really was the Son of God." And then, if we go over to John, the fifth chapter, John chapter 5, that Jesus references his father working on the Sabbath, right? So Mark 5:17, Yeshua says, "My father's still working, I'm working also." This is why the Jewish leaders began trying all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, all right? Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he also called God his own father, making himself equal with God. So Chuck, on the broad level, there are many different ways that the term Son of God could be understood. The way Yeshua used it, the way he answered those asking, "Are you the Son of God?" He was clearly speaking himself, number one, in a highly exalted way, higher than just humanity, and then in a very special and unique relationship with God, to the point that it drew resistance and people wanting to stone him and people saying, "You're guilty of blasphemy." So in that sense, it must have been understood to the Jewish hearers that Son of God meant Son of God the way we would use it in a Christian sense. Whether there was a full-blown Trinitarian understanding or not isn't the issue. The issue is that they recognize he's claiming some type of divine status here or some type of equal status with God, or he's going to come at the right hand of God. That's the place of power. That's saying a lot. And that was obviously part of what Son of God could mean in the first century.
Okay. That's it for me, man. I really appreciate
right.
that.
God bless you, buddy. Keep up your studies.
You also.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure thing. 866-348-7884. If you have not yet read my article, which just posted, I don't know, an hour or two ago, and it's got over 1,000 shares already on the Stream website on CNN's Mark Lamont Hill. He really did call for the elimination of Israel. And I start the article by saying it doesn't matter what spin is put on this in the days ahead. The meaning was clear and unmistakable. So I know there's going to be a spin. I know it's going to be, "No, I didn't mean that." Well, when you use certain words, they have certain meaning. And words are used with intentionality. Now, look, over the course of a radio show, I might say something quickly, and spontaneously. And then I said, well, hang on, let me clarify that, because I realized how it might sound. Or, you know, I realized that sounded a certain way. Let me explain that. That's one thing. Anybody can do that. When you are giving a speech in a given setting, and one that you've had time to think about and prepare, and in that particular setting, you use certain words, phrases, terminology, and you talk about a free Palestine from the river, meaning the Jordan River, to the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, you know what you mean. You know what you mean. And if you want to say, I'm advocating for Israel to lead the way in a one-state solution and that there are equal rights for all and no discrimination, you say that. Those are very different words, very different sentiments, very different goals. So make sure you read the article and share it. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, we are going straight to Aaron. Just call. We got you on the air instantly. Go for it.
Hey, Dr. Ball, how you doing?
Good, man. Need you to speak right into that phone so I can hear you clearly.
All right. I actually have headphones on, so I'm trying to speak as clearly as possible.
All right, go for it.
I was wondering if I could ask you a quick question, then ask one more. Do you believe that all of the New Testament teach and observe the Old Testament law?
Well, when you say taught, do you mean that he said that all Jewish believers must observe the Torah? Do you mean that he said everyone, Jews and Gentiles, must observe the Torah? Just so I can answer correctly.
Yes. Like, did he teach the faith of Christ along with observing the Torah?
Okay. He absolutely categorically did not demand that all believers observe the Torah, even Jewish believers. He did not demand that. He did not advocate leaving the traditions and the customs and the laws, but he recognized that God had done a new and better thing in the Messiah that was now transcendent. As to how he lived, as far as we could tell, he observed the laws. When we go through the book of Acts, we see him living as an observant Jew. We see him taking a vow on himself in Acts, the 18th chapter, without coercion. We see him participating in the temple rituals in Acts 21 and doing so as to prove that he is not telling Jews to stop following the customs. However, he understood that there was a higher law and that life in the Spirit was transcendent, and that by walking in the Spirit and loving one another, we fulfilled the law. And therefore, in situations where, for example, if he had to eat a certain food to reach people, he would certainly do that rather than say, well, I can't touch that. We'll be right back. Stay here.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Hey, all next week, we have special broadcasts prepared for you as I'm scheduled to be ministering in India. So leaving for India on Sunday, returning from India the following Sunday, God willing, with some very special time with my dear friend Yesu Padam there. Just wonderful time to be together and enjoy God's blessing and serve my friends over there. So thank you for praying, if you think of it. But every day next week, we've got a special broadcast already prepared, so be sure not to miss a single day. So, Aaron, let me just say that there's massive debate about Paul, massive debate about what he taught, massive debate about how he lived. That's as best as I understand things after 47 years of thinking about it and looking at it. So, again, you said it's a quick question. I gave you a quick answer, but of course, we could talk about these things for days, weeks, months. All right, your second question.
Just real quick, only because I'm just trying to, and I believe, I kind of believe the same things. And I actually, because I followed you a lot and you gave me a lot of understanding with the Jewish and the New Testament. So we have some people out here that are saying that, that we should, that although the law does not save us, the only faith in Christ saves us, but we should still follow what we can, kind of in the same sense that when the Israelites were in bondage to other nations, they couldn't observe all the law, but they would observe what they could.
Yeah, so the profound difference between those two things is that the Messiah hadn't come yet. So they were waiting. They were in exile. They were longing. Something was terribly wrong. They were under divine judgment and pleading for mercy. Now the Messiah has come and given us a better way. You've got to look at the fact that so much of the law centered around temple, sacrifice, priesthood, those kinds of things. 75% of the commandments that were given forever, the Jewish people have not been able to keep for almost 2,000 years. Yeshua said he didn't come to abolish the law of the prophets, but to fulfill. So what does he do with the sacrifice system, the atonement system? He brings it to fulfillment. He completes it. So we don't need blood sacrifices. If we had a temple standing and had the ability, we wouldn't be going there. We don't need blood sacrifices. The better has come. In the same way, there were things in the law that were pointing to the Messiah. Now that he came, Paul makes it very clear in Galatians, the third chapter, we're no longer under the tutelage of the law. You can look at the law, the Torah, as wonderful from God, reflecting God's character and nature as kind of a scaffolding for the building. When the building is built, all the scaffolding is not needed. We are now enjoying a new and better covenant. So if God lays it on the heart, for example, of a Gentile believer to observe seventh-day Sabbath, well, wonderful. There's nothing saying you shouldn't do that or can't do that, a Jew or a Gentile. And if God lays it on the heart of a believer, you should keep the dietary laws. It's good to do it. Fine. But if you do it in a way that we're required to, or that will be more spiritual if we do, Jesus addresses that in Matthew 15 and Mark 7, making clear that what comes in our mouths in the immediate context, whether it's eaten with unwashed hands or not, but the spiritual principle that what comes in your mouth doesn't defile you. Because it's defilement is a spiritual thing. What comes in your mouth goes in one place and comes out another, and that's it. It passes through your body. It doesn't touch your spirit. So if we make things that were natural now have a spiritual import, we're making a mistake. The other thing is no place anywhere in the New Testament does it say you should do this. And in fact, when the Galatians were told, unless you obey the law of Moses, you're circumcised and obey the law of Moses, you can't be saved. Paul said, you've fallen for grace. He said, no, we recognize we're saved anyway. Yeah, I understand, but you're heading in the same direction that the Galatians headed, ultimately. You say, well, Acts 15, that's where it's taught. No, it's taught, the opposite is taught in Acts 15. Because there were Pharisees, there were Jewish believers from the Pharisees who were saying to the Gentile believers, you have to be circumcised, you have to obey the law. And Peter said, no, don't put this extra bondage on them, this extra responsibility, this extra burden, I should say. Don't put it on them. And the apostles share, Paul shares the miracles that he's seen and what God's done confirming his message of grace among the Gentiles without a requirement to keep the law. And then from there, Jacob, James, they draft a letter with the affirmation of the Holy Spirit saying that you only have to keep these basic commandments. These are just first basic things which would prevent table fellowship in which there would be misunderstanding between Jewish and Gentile believers, these most fundamental things. And then it says this, for Moses has been taught in the synagogue for centuries. Now, some advocate that means that they'll hear the teaching of Moses, they'll get the rest. They would start here, they'll hear Moses, and they'll get the rest of the law. Well, first, the letter to them said you don't have to keep the rest, and their Gentiles rejoiced when they heard it. It's like, okay, because that's a lot of responsibility and laws and customs and that were given for Israel, and if we have to keep all that, then, boy, that's to have equal status, that's very intense. So that's the first thing. First thing is that's specifically not what they taught, and the Gentiles reacted excitedly, not like, oh, but we're going to get the rest later. The second thing is plenty of Gentile believers were not in the synagogues. And we're not going to hear this at all. So that's clearly not what Jacob meant. And then thirdly, a viable interpretation, and there are quite a few possible interpretations. Another viable interpretation is they've heard this enough, so these basic things we're given, they'll be able to get that. They'll be familiar with these things because they've been hearing it for a long time. Those who are God-fearing Gentiles in the synagogue, they've been hearing it. Another way to hear it, to understand is, look, don't try to put them under the law. They've heard that already, and that didn't save them. And bring them into equal status in God. So you honor the Lord, center on life in Yeshua, life in the Spirit, faith in Him. And as a Jewish believer, if God lays it on your heart to show deeper covenantal solidarity with your people, be part of a Messianic congregation, live by the Jewish calendar, wonderful. If a Gentile believer, you love being in a Messianic Jewish congregation, wonderful. But it is not, it is not anything that is in any way mandatory, or that if you do that, everyone should do it. Certainly not. Sinai Covenant had its purpose and its place. All right. I've got time for another call. Let's go to Elizabeth in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hello.
I have a question I've been trying to find an answer to for a long time, and I'm hoping you can give it to me.
Sure.
Jews today, whether they're reformist or conservative or orthodox, you know, are not covered under the blood of Jesus, that they've rejected and don't do animal sacrifices. You were just talking about that. How do Jews today atone for their sin?
Right. So this is a common question that Christians ask. And I'm just going to check something. I'm going to type in the word Chabad, okay, on my computer. So Chabad. And I'll say, how do Jews atone for their sins? And here the first article that comes up is called Atonement in the Absence of Sacrifices. So when I'm done, if you go to your computer, your cell phone, and type in Chabad, that's C-H-A-B-A-D. This is an Orthodox Jewish organization, okay? C-H-A-B-A-D. And then how do Jews atone for their sins? You'll get the answer immediately from a traditional viewpoint. So in the traditional mindset, that sacrifices were important, but repentance was the biggest thing. And in the absence of temple sacrifices, Jews pray and give charity. And maybe if you go through suffering in your own life, that takes the place of it. So that as long as there's true repentance and prayer and these other things, that takes the place of sacrifices. Now, obviously, I don't agree with that. And I've written at great length about it in volume 2 of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. But if you'll go there, all right, Elizabeth, so Chabad, C-H-A-B-A-D, and then type in, how do Jews atone for their sins? You'll read a okay, great. So that will give you what a traditional Jew has to say. Now, after going through it, if you have questions, just shoot a note to our website, and we'll be happy to give you references responding to that. But I want you to get it from their viewpoint, okay? They'll explain it, and then you can see what makes sense to you and what you still differ with. And obviously, we feel very fundamentally, that without the Messiah's blood, there is no atonement. And the reason there's been no temple for sacrifices is because God was making clear this is the way. All right, thank you very much for the call. And as always, I do my best to be fair to those I differ with, especially my own Jewish family and Jewish community, and present those views, hence giving a link there. Hey, Matt, let's grab that video. It's talking with Israelis on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and it's a ceremony called Kaparas, all right? Kaparas is done, it's around the time of the Jewish New Year and Day of Atonement. It can be in between those days, where a Jewish person will take a chicken or a rooster, and it's dead, be killed, and swing it around their head and say, this is my atonement, this is my exchange, this is my replacement. It's very interesting that it's like a substitute blood sacrifice, and some of the Jewish community really rejects it, but it has been commonly practiced. So we have a link talking with Israelis about Yom Kippur and about Kaparas, about how they receive atonement, and you'll get their varied opinions. All right, friends, I'm out of here, but don't let me be out of sight, out of mind. Connect with me on social media, because every day we do a live stream of the broadcast, Facebook, YouTube, and we post over the course of months hundreds of new articles, videos, links, quotes. So connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, all at my website, AskDrBrown.org. Back with you tomorrow.